bring this work session to the Planning Commission to order. And tonight, we have the topic of ethics. Lauren King, 45 minutes.
There you go. Okay, well, so I'm going to keep it kind of even broader than ethics. We're going to talk about legal issues. What I like is to kind of keep it as much of a conversation. I don't want to just have a lecture. So feel free to chime in, including staff, Brendan and Greg and Mary Bridget, so that we can, this can be as productive and informative as you'd like. I made a little, this is a kind of handout just to follow while we talk through it. Yeah, however you want. And then I have more detailed documents that I can give you before you go, but didn't want to bombard you with too much text. What I thought would be helpful, I think several of you have gone through legal ethics training with me. I don't think Commissioner James might be the only one that I haven't done one with, but he's been doing this long enough that he's familiar with all of the big topics that we usually talk about. And so what I thought would be helpful to kind of for tonight is to maybe focus on some key phrases we hear often. Hey, we're just getting started. That's okay. Some key phrases that often come up in land use and kind of explaining what they actually mean and diving in a little bit deeper about their significance so that you can make informed decisions and understand what's going on. So just to start off, there's this little chart, and a lot of this material is I took from, there's a publication that the department used to put out called Putting People in the Planning, and it was intended to inform planning commissioners but also citizens about the role that citizens play. So that's where a lot of this comes from, and including this first table that divides the different types of decisions. Now, you hear us talk a lot about quasi-judicial and legislative, but the ministerial, unless you're on the DAC, you might not have heard about them. And so those are the decisions that the planning, type one decisions that the planning staff makes without exercising any discretion. They're applications for projects that don't really require anything more than checking off a list and saying, does this property have, you know, the minimum number of parking spaces or meet these things? Those are not appealable decisions, so you wouldn't see one of those decisions. But I wanted you to understand, because they are part of the development code, and certainly with the DAC, and depending on what happens and with or where that ends up, that topic will come up a little more and come before the Planning Commission and the City Council. And maybe Commissioner James, do you want to touch on a little bit what the DAC's trying to do?
Well, the Development Advisory Committee has been working over the last how many years? Going on three now.
Yeah, I think so.
One of the things we've been attempting to do is expand some of the ministerial aspects of what can be done or under the umbrella of the ministerial or staff review, just to allow a little more flexibility for developers. Often developers feel, part of the direction of the DAC was to make Springfield feel more like we were open for business. And part of the feeling was in that community was that it was very difficult to do relatively simple projects without going through a quasi-judicial process to make a project come together. So, and as a matter of fact, right now we are at a stage where legal counsel is reviewing some of the information that the DAC has developed and put together that could open up another tier under the ministerial review process. So anyway, that's kind of what's going on at the DAC. Anything to add?
Just maybe that we went through the code to see where clearly there was a discretionary item or whether something could be slightly reworded to make it a ministerial decision, that type of thing.
Yeah, well, go ahead.
You mind, just for me, I guess,
distinguish, maybe some point during discussions, a couple examples, you know.
Sure, absolutely.
Just help me get a picture.
So ministerial examples would be, help me out, Greg.
There's a site plan modification, mm-hmm. I think, is ministerial.
Like a tree felling permit is, isn't it?
I think so. Should have
run. Depends.
Can we get in here, or is it locked?
We've discussed it quite a bit. Just about anything that you could go down a checklist and say, yes, this driveway is within this amount of feet from the intersection, and yes, it's this width. And
yeah.
It's to me, it was like you could approve a development through following a checklist that it met the standards.
So
clearly, without a interpretation of the standards.
So have you guys had a discussion about clear and objective standards and what that means in the law?
We have.
And how it relates to what we have?
Mm-hmm.
You know that, well, you may not know this, but there's a land use attorney who has a lot of clients in Springfield. His name's Bill Close. And he took the city of Eugene to task about clear and objective standards on a couple of occasions. And whenever he has, he's always won those cases at LUBA, because you either have clear and objective standards or you don't.
Right.
And as it relates to Goal 10, housing,
mm-hmm.
the law is intended to really sort of dig in and say you need to have clear and objective standards when it comes to the provision of housing. And
as opposed to maybe discretionary standard where you're exercising discretion.
Yeah, you can have a route or a path that's discretionary, but mm-hmm. you also are supposed to provide one that's not. That's just clear and objective. Just as you say, Mike, you meet the standards and you get your approval basically mm-hmm. over the counter. So we're not there yet. And, it may be that a recommendation of the DAC is that the city should undertake an objective exercise to make certain standards in the code. Now, if there's any question about them being discretionary, particularly if it relates to Goal 10, change it so that it's clear and objective.
That's part of the process.
I don't think as it relates things like subdivisions and partitions and site plans that you can get there.
Right.
The statute's clear with respect to subdivisions and partitions. You have to do this.
Right.
And the statute says that it's a type 2 land use action. You have to notify neighbors. You have to give them an opportunity to review and comment. And you make a decision and you send them a notice of the decision, and then they would appeal to the Planning Commission. On a ministerial act, a type 1, neighbors don't even get notified.
Mm-hmm.
It's just an action between the city and the applicant, and they go off and do it.
But the assumption is that it really shouldn't be something that's going to upset the neighbors. I mean, for instance, we had a discussion a month ago on a cell tower. You could make up a checklist that says, well, do I have everything I need for a cell tower?
Yeah, so the... But
neighbors might not want this 120-foot tree next to their house.
So that's where I think the kind of thinking about the three different types is important. So the idea would be, as in a ministerial type of decision, at some point the Planning Commission and the City Council took legislative action to adopt code. At that point the public could have participated, and then that code is adopted such that it's really just a checklist that staff's applying, but it's very clear and objective and there is no discretion, and so therefore the public has already said, yes, we're okay with it when the legislative changes were made, and they don't necessarily get the right to come in and comment. But you have to be careful because, Oregon Land Use definitely wants to provide more public notice, and I mean, that's the direction that the state's always moved in, and so I think that's Greg's point when he says that Bill Close is taking Eugene to task because constantly challenging the question of whether or not it truly is clear and objective, and the courts are inclined to really look hard at whether or not it truly is clear and objective. And so it's a very high bar to meet.
One trigger, I guess, is the proper word to describe it, that kind of distinguishes between clear and objective and discretionary is if the staff is sort of compelled to say, well, you can do this, but. Mm-hmm. And the but is you need to move it, or you need to make it smaller, you need to do something. Mm-hmm. That absolutely is not clear to the applicant at the time that mm-hmm. they submitted. They had no idea that the staff was going to say that to them. And because of that, it's not a clear and objective process. It's discretionary mm-hmm. because the staff says, well, we can't approve it unless you do this. And they didn't know that coming into it. So it's automatically elevates to a type 2 type of thing. We probably have a lot of type 2s that some communities could elevate to a type 3 mm-hmm. and say, this even exceeds what the staff should be doing.
Yeah.
This is more appropriate for the Planning Commission. But in the interest of customer service mm-hmm. and reducing costs and everything else, we lean towards trying to let the staff make a lot of these decisions. Because in a lot of cases, it's really not a life and death deal, and it's it could upset a neighbor, but it, probably not very often.
Yeah.
And it's something you want to have happen. You know, you want to have that apartment building built, or you want to have that grocery store built, or whatever it is. So if you can do it at the staff level, it's always cheaper, it's always faster. There's a direct connection between the city and the applicant with respect to what's going on. And I'm guessing that we do a lot of things at the staff level that other communities go to a hearings official.
And I think to balance that is that that staff decision that he's referring to is the type 2, so that's where staff is exercising some discretion and opposing providing conditions potentially and also providing notice. Those are appealable decisions, so those are decisions that could potentially come before you. So a type 2 and a type 3. The type 2 would be if staff issued a decision and somebody didn't like it, they appeal and come before you. Some of you might remember last summer, the Hayden Homes, that was an appealed decision that came before the Planning Commission, as opposed to type 3, which would have been the cell tower if it stayed with the Planning Commission. That was you were making that first decision, staff hadn't made a decision yet, and then your decision would get appealed to the City Council.
The Greenway setback was your decision.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, you know, whenever the staff have tried to wrestle with this clear and objective standard thing, we recognize we're vulnerable too. Bill hasn't had a lot of opportunities to challenge us, so we try and avoid that. But we recognize we're vulnerable, and the difficulty that always emerges for us when we try and talk our way through these things is, can we imagine being able to write these standards so that they'd always work? Mm-hmm. So that no matter where your property was located, how big it was, how small it was, whether it was next door to a church or next door to a swimming pool, that we would always be able to say yes, because these standards are clear, they're objective, and there's no controversy involved. There's never a circumstance where we go, oh boy, that's a question. And you know what? Every time we get there, we go, I can't imagine that. I absolutely cannot imagine that if we got 1,000 of these applications, that all 1,000 would just be a slam dunk stamp.
Yeah.
They're just going to be ones
sure.
that don't work, that don't fit. And so the question is then, all right, but if 900 of them are going to work, but 100 aren't, should we then say mm-hmm. we're going to go with clear and objective standards, however, there's this other path to get to the approval that that's not going to be a ministerial, it's going to be a type two. And we can figure that out before they submit their application. And what we call a pre-application conference or a pre-development conference. So they haven't really applied for anything. But they've come in and said, here's what I want to do, here's the property, I understand that all I have to do is satisfy your standards and I can get my approval. So am I a situation where that exists? And we'd be able to say, yes, you are, go for it. Or we'd be able to say, I don't think so.
Yeah.
We've got a stormwater management problem that exists there. The street capacity is
right
there, you know, and what you want to do will add additional trips. And so it just becomes a much more complex issue, but it's only because it's at that property and not the one around the corner.
Yeah.
And I think that's probably the sort of
potential
change
path, yeah,
that we would be looking at, that,
sure,
the kind of things we could talk to the DAC about.
Yeah.
And then the other type that you've also heard would be the legislative. So the UGB amendment is sort of a big one that's out there, but the Glenwood Refinement Plan, and these are all, or if the DAC moves forward and has proposed code changes, those would be legislative. And so just like with the legislator, those apply citywide. There's a lot of public process, not necessarily, there would be a hearing, but that's a lot of the public input comes through reaching out to stakeholders and connecting with the community. And those are complex and can take years potentially, depending on what's at stake. So another topic that we hear a lot about, if you want to flip through, I don't have actually a one of those, I just have my own. But, oh, that's fine. I mean, I have a little outline. Yeah, I can just stick it here and see. So the next is, what is an ex parte contact? And so we, you know, I talk about that at the beginning of every quasi-judicial hearing. That's when it's important for quasi-judicial hearings. And really, you know, what you need to think about as a quasi-judicial hearing is you're acting as a judge. And so, just as it wouldn't be fair in the courtroom for one party to have that kind of contact, to have one conversation with the judge, it's not really fair for the applicant or the citizens for you to have a one-sided conversation. And there's kind of two bodies of law or two authorities that really guide that. It's, you know, in Fasano is a famous land use case, and in that they is when the Supreme Court really distinguished what a quasi-judicial hearing is, and since then the legislature has adopted statute. But what the Supreme Court said was that the decision-making body must be impartial and must provide an opportunity for interested parties to rebut the evidence. And then public meetings law, which applies also to city council and all other kinds of governing body decisions, really just, you know, says the governing bodies need to make their decisions in the public. And so the combination of those two and now what's been codified in statute guides how ex parte needs to be handled. So that's not to say that you're prohibited from the contact. Ex parte contact, you're just regulated closely. So, you know, everything has to be disclosed at the start of the hearing, and the extent there is any written communication, that needs to be placed into the record. And ideally, you know, the conversations are tracked in a lot of detail because you want to give anybody a chance to rebut or challenge, you know, your either bias or what that conversation was. So we always encourage no contact because it's easier than trying to recreate what that contact was. But what's included in ex parte contact is actually a site visit, and site visits are one of the things that we do encourage. We think it's better to make a decision having seen the land. And so with site visits, you just want to make sure you disclose that you've been to the property and what you saw when you went, but they're good to have. And the other thing to be thinking about is contact with staff and contact with the city attorney's office is not ex parte communication. So that is specifically called out in the statute. So you can ask staff questions and to try to understand. you can't use staff or us as a go-between to tell the, you know, we can't be a messenger, but we can help you understand an application or what's going on or information, or maybe there are things that, you know, wow, if the applicant could, you know, show this, then staff can potentially work with the applicant to try to help them get to a place, but not necessarily, you know, you reaching a decision, if that makes sense. There's kind of a nuance there.
A good example during the time I was chair was the Hayden Home development that we had, and we processed around that. Mm-hmm. And that was a very interesting process. And I went out on multiple occasions and mm-hmm. visited that site because there were questions about, you know, the power lines, and there was some concern.
Yeah,
that's right. Traffic and the ability to see, and the time of the evening, and the overgrowth that was coming out into the street, and some of those types of things. So those were all important to the decision. Yeah. So you know, I probably went 6 or 7 times at different times of the day. It was right on my way home.
Yeah.
But I had to disclose that as ex parte mm-hmm. contact mm-hmm. Prior to the meeting, so that
people
was
knew
declared.
What you saw, and
exactly.
It's because it forms the basis of your decision.
Yeah.
Yeah. So. And then, so if there are any questions about ex parte contact or anything.
Well, you know, just an anecdotal addition to that. Back in the late 70s and early 80s, we had a van and we took the Planning Commission on a tour of all of the sites that were coming up on their agenda that night. So we'd meet at 3. And if we had 5 or 6 sites to go to, we'd go to all 5 or 6 sites. The Planning Commission would ask questions. And they'd come back feeling a little more informed on it. And although discussing that with us didn't influence the outcome, because as Lauren mentioned, it's not ex parte contact, going to the site was, plus all 6 or 7 quorum commission
meeting,
members.
Yeah.
It's a public meeting.
That's right.
So everything that's said actually needs to be revealed at the meeting. And it was years before the city attorney's office put the kibosh on it. Now, on a couple occasions, the city attorney came with us, too. So
yeah. I think
pretty quaint back then.
It's safe to say that land use and Oregon public meetings and government ethics laws just changed so much over the years. It's kind of... because same city attorney, one of the attorneys that's still in our office was around then, but I'll tell him about those various things.
Yeah,
I like to call out the things he did wrong. So another topic or phrase you hear a lot is findings. Staff will talk about findings, and when you get your packet, it's full of findings. And so a finding it's shorthand for finding of fact, and it's an official statement of facts that the hearings body, the Planning Commission in your case, relied on and the conclusions it reached in deciding a land use issue. And so findings they're important for a couple of reasons. Quasi-judicial decisions require findings by statute, and although legislative decisions don't necessarily require them, what Luba has said is, you know, in order to say that this decision was proper, you need them for legislative decision as well. And what findings do, why they're important for both decisions, is they provide a paper trail, and it tells the story. You may have a hearing where 10 people come and they all talk about why, you know, a variance is needed for a steep slope on a property, and everyone's submitting evidence, and so it's really obvious to you that the slope is steep. But when it gets appealed, LUBA doesn't have the people in front of them. They don't know what you know. They didn't go to the site, and so it provides that story, provides the record. It also provides your rationale, and then it helps the Planning Commission or helps the governing body kind of focus on the issues and the applicable laws. So when staff drafts their staff report, they go through what the code is, and they make findings based on that. And so this way, as in a quasi-judicial decision, you can't, and legislative, you know, you have law that guides kind of what you can do and what you can't do. The findings help narrow on the criteria. So I encourage you to, of course, review the findings, but challenge them and understand
that's,
them.
That's a point. Yeah. I think that's a really good point. I mean, findings of fact is really what they're called. But the reality is, and the staff do an excellent job of developing findings that are based on the code and the statute. But sometimes it may not be clear, or you may not totally understand or necessarily agree with their findings.
Yep.
You know, they have developed these findings that say the slope is such that houses can be built on this incline, and they will have all kinds of backup information to support that. The geoengineer and so on and so forth. But you live out in that area and you've observed water running down that slope, and you can't possibly see
sure.
how you could build a structure
yeah.
on that slope, you know. This part of your role as a planning commissioner is to question staff about the findings, and ultimately you're a decision maker, and that's part of the information you bring to the decision.
And the other thing that, I agree that staff does do a good job and they do tell the story, but you know, there are also times when staff, there could be more data provided. There could be, you know, a planner might say there's no traffic impact. Well, you know, it's okay. I mean, it's part of your responsibility to say, well, I want to know what the traffic engineer says. What do the folks in the traffic department have to say about whether or not it actually has that impact? Or, you know, environmental services. And it's good. It's good for staff. It's good for Springfield to kind of challenge and really make sure that finding is based on an analysis of the right person that's supposed to do the analysis, you know. So, and that gets to the next thing, which is substantial evidence. So findings must be supported by substantial evidence. And so along the same lines, the slope or the traffic, you want it to have that evidentiary basis. And the standard is what a reasonable person considering all of the evidence may rely on to make a decision. So it is a modest standard. But it's the better evidence you can get, the more likely the decision will be upheld on remand. So the more supported it is, the more likely it will be upheld. Certainly, there are things where you might not necessarily have a noise engineer look at everything if they're talking about, you know, no significant sounds and someone's putting in a residential house or, you know, certain things like that, but that might be common sense. But there are other times with an industrial facility or with the cell tower where you say, well, I do want to know what, you know, the noise analysis is on that.
And we had that with the cell tower recently and the backup generator. What was the sound? Another recent decision was a setback line. The hearings official said, is this the line? Is this the actual line? Mm-hmm. And staff said, well, no, it's not the actual line.
Yep.
And he said, well, you know, can you provide that actual line within a reasonable period of time?
Sure.
And the answer was yes, and that satisfied.
And then if a decision were to be appealed, and what LUBA looks at when they look for substantial evidence is whether or not the entire record is based on substantial evidence. So that's the inquiry. And so one of the cases that's often cited is the relevant inquiry into considering an evidentiary challenge to a land use decision is whether the evidentiary record viewed as a whole includes supporting evidence that a reasonable person could rely on to adopt the land use decision. So you may not necessarily, as you're all reasonable people, but you may not necessarily agree on one particular piece of evidence or one nuance, but as a whole, if you can support, and if as a whole you could look at that record and say, okay, this was a decision that made sense and was consistent with the criteria, was consistent with the law. So those are things we can do.
It's, and I'm thinking of the Greenway setback as an example, and a kind of a lesson learned for me early on in this whole distinction about findings and evidence is that you don't want to confuse findings and evidence with the truth of things, because they're not always the same. You use the findings and evidence to get to the truth of this, and then that's your conclusion and the reason that you've done something. When we adopted the part one or phase one of the Glenwood Refinement Plan, we included a 75-foot greenway setback as part of that action. The findings that were used to support that was that the city has a riparian setback from class one streams of 75 feet. It's a federal, it's in response to the Clean Water Act and the Endangered Species Act. It has nothing to do with the greenway or with Goal 5.
Right.
It's strictly a federal thing. And because the feds have a different standard, we were able to adopt that to show compliance with that law. And we didn't have to go through the kind of elaborate dance that we do with findings on state law matters. But the LUBA rejected that. And they rejected it because, okay, a fact is true. You do have the 75-foot riparian setback, and it's also true that some of the objectives of that riparian setback are similar and overlap with the greenway. But the greenway says you establish that setback based on a number of factors, including the inventory of the riparian features that are present there. And so 75 feet's meaningless with respect to the greenway. It only has a relationship if that happens to be where the riparian vegetation is. Otherwise, it could be 8 feet, or it could be 85 feet, or anything in between. It could even be more than that. So LUBA said, this is no good. You need to go back and do what the law requires you to do. And so that's why you guys, twice, as it turns out, established where that greenway setback should be. And that was based on the evidence on the land that supported the decision to make it.
And applying the criteria.
Yeah, and it's all over the place, as you well know.
Yeah.
So, on the one hand, it was factual evidence that was submitted with the refinement plan. But it didn't address those criteria, and that's why it was rejected. One other thing.
Yeah.
Well, lots of times your findings and conclusions are supporting a policy that applies to a given land use decision. And LUBA will give the community deference on the interpretation of those policies and the findings that they generate that support that policy, as long as you don't violate the Constitution in doing that, and you don't grossly misinterpret your own policy, so that half of us at the table, if we just said, okay, here's the policy and here's how we're going to implement it, and the other half said, what are you talking about? I have absolutely no conscious connection with what you're saying. If that's the kind of reaction that the appellant is giving, and LUBA agrees with that, then local deference is not granted, and you have to go back and do a better job at it.
And so, and it's actually city council that gets the deference, but what jurisdictions often do, if they're anticipating a question about how the planning commission or how the city wants to interpret a policy, is that the city council could then adopt your decision, and so then the city would still get deference. And I think a recent example, and Greg can speak to this more, is in Eugene with putting the VA hospital that was how the city of Eugene interpreted their code to say that that was an appropriate use for that site was a stretch. And so, they, you know, then they want the city council to then adopt the decision and make it clear so that they can get deference in how they interpreted the code. Another phrase you might hear sometimes is standing. And so standing is your qualification to be able to assert a legal right. In land use, and it's pretty broad, we generally, and even Springfield's code is written very broad, that people have the ability to participate. It does depend on the type of decision, though. So with a type 2 decision, for example, that's the kind of decision where staff issues a final decision, people get notice, and then someone has the opportunity to appeal. And those people who receive the notice and appealed in a timely manner can then appear before you. Because we encourage more public participation, often those are heard as de novo, which means we allow everyone to come in and participate. And so there might not necessarily be everyone that appealed that will have standing. So what you'll usually see as a planning commission is really people who receive notice are the ones that come, but anyone who's aggrieved and can make a case, and we have a pretty broad interpretation of what that is. So there's a variety of people. Where standing becomes more relevant is before LUBA. And so one of the things that I read in the beginning of a quasi-judicial hearing is this raise it or waive it, how you could lose your opportunity to discuss a topic or take issue with something before LUBA if you don't raise it in front of the Planning Commission. So not only does the person need to appear before you in writing or orally, but they also need to raise issues. And if they're not raised before you, then they can't try to appeal them. And that's important because it gives the city an opportunity to respond to their issues. If they are just coming and saying, well, I don't like this application, and they don't say why, and then before LUBA they start attacking our code, well, we didn't have an opportunity to address those, and that's not really very fair to the city. So standing and this idea of appearance ties to the raise it or waive it, which I have a little bit later.
So what you're saying is if they don't bring those things up at, mm-hmm. at a hearing, they do not have legal standing with yeah. LUBA to yes. question those.
And so a lot of times, or appeal those. Certainly when there's an attorney or applicants, or excuse me, people providing testimony, they might say a lot of stuff.
Yeah.
And it kind of preserves all the different goals and tries to attack as much as they can, because you do want to preserve that right.
Sure.
And then certainly we have lots of people that come in and testify. They're not represented by an attorney. They might be new to this process, have never experienced it. And so they'll talk about things in a kind of roundabout way. It's not quite directed at the code. They'll still be able to make a connection. What I was talking about was the traffic impact, even though I said, I don't know, there's no stop sign, or, you know, who knows what it is. But yeah, it is significant. And, you know, it's important for you as planning commissioners to kind of listen to what they're saying and see, you know, okay, it's not, I think this is what they're trying, what their issue really is. You know, I think it's a screening issue with the trees, you know, or I think it's traffic is a noise, you know, but not, that's not quite what they're saying, and to kind of get that information out of them so that staff before your, and the planning commission before the final decision can respond to that, and we can have a good record.
Lots of times the testimony will be directed at something that's in the application or something that the staff has generated. And the it's not an attack, but it's a position that's contrary to what's in there. And frequently you'll hear testimony that you really have to struggle to see the connection between what it is they're saying and mm-hmm. what's in that staff report. But they're making that attempt. And I think it would be useful for the Planning Commission, and certainly it would reflect positively on your effort to get as much public testimony as you can and understand where they're coming from, to ask them about that.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, you say you don't agree with this, but you're really not saying why mm-hmm. it is that you don't agree.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think our calculation is wrong? Should we have done this analysis at a different time of the day?
Mm-hmm. You know,
that sort of thing. It's not contrary to your role to listen to things and sort through them and make a decision. I think it's a clear permission for you to examine that. It's not like you're cross-examining or grilling somebody.
Sure.
But if somebody just says, well, I don't like it and I don't agree with this, there's nowhere for you guys to go with that. Because you hear that a lot.
Yeah.
Somebody just doesn't want it in their neighborhood. There's nothing there for you to discuss.
I've a little bit wondered about the workings of that because, you know, obviously I haven't been here for very long, but, you know, sometimes it seems like people come up and they testify and they say their piece and we kind of wisely nod our heads and look sage and nobody says anything.
Yeah.
You know, we talk to the advocate or, you know, the city.
Yeah.
You know, person, but
so
we haven't talked to those that are coming to testify. Should we?
What I would recommend
as a point of clarification, comfort.
Exactly. You can, as a point of clarification, yes. To further understand and to ask questions, yes. What you don't want to do, though, is give the appearance that you've made a decision or show agreement or disagreement. You want to, you know, to kind of further understand, but not necessarily say, you know, I'm not going to approve this or I agree or, you know, that kind of thing. But I think it's okay to ask more questions. And we had actually the wireless facility went to the city council last night, and the city council did just that. A lot more people came to testify last night, and you know they made sure to ask a lot of questions about what people were saying. So that's okay. Yeah. Another word we use a lot is notice. And so notice is actually a noun. It's in the land use context, it's a notification to interested parties is kind of the shorthand notice. And there's different kind of notice required for different kinds of decisions, as you can imagine. And this is governed by state law and the code. And it's important to provide notice. It gives these parties an opportunity to participate in the decision, and it gives them an opportunity to challenge the decision. The law is pretty clear about who gets notice and what the notice needs to include, including obviously the time and the place of the hearing and how to challenge, and who to contact on staff, as well as the criteria for the application. And so if you might recall with the Willamette Greenway, that was part of the issue, is that the notice didn't include the criteria. And so then the people didn't know that they could, well, maybe if, you know, I'm just throwing out an example, but if one of the criteria was a certain kind of protecting endangered species or something, but we didn't include that, then they wouldn't know to come forward and talk about that. And what happens is if someone doesn't get notice, then they have the ability to appeal for a much longer time. So until either it can extend on and on, or until they become aware of the decision, then their clock starts running. As opposed to those who got notice, the clock starts and they have to appeal, and if they don't appeal, then we're good and we move on and we don't have to worry. But to protect kind of issues down the road that might come up, it's important to make sure your notice is clear. And that's more on the staff end, but I wanted you to understand, you know, what that means. Or when people come in and they say, and sometimes you might hear this, well, I didn't get notice. And so, you know, that's a good time to check in with staff. Well, can you tell me a little bit more about what notice was done? And usually, more often than not, when people come in and say they didn't get notice, it's because it got tossed in the garbage or something, because it came from the city. And staff has to do an affidavit, and they have a lot of documentation about who got notice. So if someone does say that, it's worth pausing and kind of questioning and getting more information to make sure everybody else got notice and that it was done right.
Typically, always the notice information is brought out in the findings of fact.
Mm-hmm. And
that's always part of those findings. But we have had situations during my time on the Planning Commission, the tree felling situation where notice was actually didn't get out to everyone that it was supposed to go to because of a software glitch or something.
Yeah.
So those questions are important to ask.
Yeah. Absolutely.
And we've rescheduled and extended records so that our files, clearly when they're there.
They now have noticed.
They've shown up, so they know.
But there might be others who didn't get noticed. So yes, we would, if they tried to appeal because they didn't get noticed, well, we would say they came to the hearing, they obviously had notice.
Yeah.
But it does give you pause to say, okay, well, are there others? How was this done? And just to double check. You know, and it the software glitch or, you know, decisions, mistakes, and errors that get made. I mean, it's always worth the more eyes, the better, and it's part of, you know, your responsibility. You're the ones adopting the decision to kind of be thinking about that. And I think then, and we discussed the raise it or waive it, so I'll skip to the last one, and then I'll wrap up because my time is done. But we talk a lot about, and this ties into extending the record, is this 120-day rule. So under Oregon law, cities have 120 days from the day an application is stamped as complete to issue a decision. If a decision is not issued in that time period, the applicant can go to circuit court, not LUBA, and get a writ of mandamus. And essentially what the circuit court has to approve the decision unless the city can demonstrate that there would be this significant violation by approving that application. So what you would lose often if something went to a writ of mandamus and got approval at circuit court is the ability to impose conditions and really look at the application and do kind of those finer details. Certainly if an application was way out there and in no way could be consistent with the code, we would make that argument at circuit court and hopefully we wouldn't get a writ of mandamus, but we don't want to test that out. It is a statutory right that people get 120 days and staff makes every effort to comply with that.
This
is for type 2 permit. So type 2 also 120 days, right?
Yeah.
And 3, and then do type 1 have 120 days? No. What is
no
their
notice.
Timeline? No notice, but...
No notice.
But when you apply, it's still...
But I think it's specifically exempted from...
It's a permit, because it's a permit, it's have the type 2. Yeah. So land use decisions, and that would be exempt from how that's interpreted in the statute. That's a good question. And there are extensions, and a lot of times the city will try to work with the applicant to get an extension on that 120 days, and the applicant will be willing to give it because it's in their favor to play nice with the city, but they don't have to. I mean, they get to decide whether or not that they want to extend, and they could say no, you know, get your decision done within that time period. So on a rare occasion, if timing doesn't line up right, you might be called back in from a recess, or we might have a meeting on a, you know, an off day or an off week so that we can comply with that timeline. And that timeline includes staff reviewing, staff writing the staff report, and going through any necessary appeal process. I mean, it's the city final decision. So if you're,
a lot goes on.
Yeah, so that's a short timeline if it's, you know, a type 2 and then it gets appealed and it goes before you. And and so that's it's easy to imagine how you can run up against that clock.
I think that's why they instilled the DAM development issue meetings,
mm-hmm.
so they can kind of go through and show them what it's
exactly.
lacking.
Before it's approved.
Before they even apply.
Before it's deemed to complete. Yeah. Excuse me. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, and that's, and there are some applications. This went to the hearings official, not the planning commission. But there was an application to do a home ock on a property for a wedding venue. And when the application first came in, it didn't really address the criteria. And so staff then had 30 days to write back and say, this doesn't address the criteria, this application is incomplete. And then the applicant, by statute, has, they can either say, no, review that as is, and then the clock continues, or they can say, okay, I'm going to submit something, or they do nothing, and then after a year, the application just expires and they would have to apply again. But their timeline's worth watching because it's easy to run up against them, and it's just not good land use when we end up in circuit court because it's not where we belong.
It's terrible.
Yeah.
It really is.
I've been involved in one of the land bans, and it was really unfortunate because the action was a staff decision on particular development proposal, and the staff supported that, but the neighborhood didn't, and the neighborhood appealed. And the applicant requested that the hearing, this was around Thanksgiving when the hearing was made, and they were going to be in town, so they requested that it be rescheduled until after the new year. We were counting, but because they requested that, it was about a 26-day adjustment of the notice, or of the hearing date. We thought they understood they were extending the record from the 120 days to basically 146 days by doing that. So we operated on that assumption. And we even talked to them about it, and they said, oh yeah, no problem. We didn't get anything in writing. Mm-hmm. And on the 121st day, we still hadn't had the hearing yet, because it was that was December 28th or 29th. They filed with the court, and that's where it went. And what the only thing the judge was concerned about at all was, did you or did you not complete the review and decision in 120 days?
Yeah.
And we said, well, no, unfortunately, that's the end, though.
Yeah.
They got approval. So he didn't even talk about the action and what it was. When we brought up the metro plan and how it was inconsistent with the metro plan, he said, what's the metro plan?
Yeah, that's why you don't want to end up in circuit court because they don't know any of our land use staff.
So he didn't really care when we tried to explain.
The question is, did you do it in 120 days?
Did the metro plan about this 120 days?
Yeah.
No, okay then. Case dismissed. You know, they got what they wanted. We actually have in our budget a performance measure for processing these applications. And it's, I think, around 70 days. So that's what our objective is to be done with it in 70 days, either at the staff or at the planning commission. So we still have 50 days to take it to the council for the appeal. Or in our case, to take it to you guys for the appeal. And that beats the 120-day time. And if we're about day 50 and it doesn't look like we're going to be done by day 70, that's when we contact the applicant and say, can we have a 10-day extension or a 15-day extension?
And you get it in writing.
And we get it in writing.
Yeah, we have a form.
A form.
So
date notarized.
Do we have one more meeting this summer, or is this the last one?
Well, we don't have anything scheduled for it.
So right now, yeah.
So we could.
Well, so I don't want to keep you into your summer recess then much longer. I was only allotted 45 minutes and I've gone over. I did print out just more lengthy, for those of you who do like to read, kind of my notes, as well as the packet that I use when we first get new planning commissioners. So you can stick these in your binder, or if you they go together. If topics come up and you want to check your resources, but I know Brendan gives you a big binder so that you can go in there. But thank you so much for your time, and definitely our office, and I know Greg feels the same way, we're always available. So if there are questions or things you don't understand, I mean, send us an email or pull us aside, because the more you understand, I think the more fun it is for you, the more, you know, the more interesting it is to come to these meetings, and obviously the better you serve the community. And I'm a big land use nerd, so I think this is all really fun and interesting, but I know that it can be complex for some. And, you know, last night having a land use hearing before the city council, which was the first in a while, you could tell that there was just too many rules for some people. But it's good. Anyway, thank you, and have a good summer. Turn it over to the chair.
I think Lauren already said the cell tower.
Yeah.
They'll make a decision on July 20th.
Oh, it's continued.
Somebody asked to keep the record open.
Yeah, and that's the council's last meeting until like the 15th of September too. So the interesting stuff happened last night. The continued meeting will just. But obviously, you know, I don't know if anybody has that as an assignment to attend.
Someone does, but I don't know who it is.
It'd be tough to remember what happened when you guys come back.
Well, it's that calendar. It says who goes to what meeting. It's in your big book.
Oh, yeah. Okay.
But I can email it again.
Yeah, when that got sent to the council, I asked the question, you know, is this going to run into a problem with the 120 days?
We're still good, but if...
It was May 1, so yeah. May is 30, June's 60,
you're
July
close.
Is 90.
Yeah.
So we're at 90.
Mm-hmm. What was more likely the problem I was going to run into, which was keeping council out of recess, so we had to staff and the applicant.
We actually had to waive our time period to respond.
Yeah.
A number of, looks like a number of them, the 13th, the 20th, and the 27th.
Are all you?
No.
Yeah. They're not having a meeting on the 27th. The 20th is their last one.
Oh, okay. I've got Nelson on the 13th and Greg on the 20th.
That'll be a long night. There's a lot of things on the agenda.
They just have a work session on the 27th.
Yeah.
Is that the one that was like 15 minutes or something?
It was the one about the El Rapa appointment.
Okay.
So,
yeah.
That's kind of interesting.
Well,
okay. Yes, summer.